In the early 19th century, a boat full of New England missionaries landed in Maui to spread Christianity, literacy, and capitalism to the islands. In other words, their version of America. Sarah Vowell tells the story of what followed, leading up to the annexation of Hawaii in 1898, in her latest book, Unfamiliar Fishes. She visited our show earlier this year to discuss it, and listeners told us they really enjoyed the segment, so we thought we'd re-air it for you again as we start the 4th of July holiday weekend. I began by noting that her last book, The Wordy Shipmates, was about the Massachusetts Bay colonists, and I asked Sarah Vowell, is this a continuation of that story?
It is kind of a sequel just because of those New England missionaries, and they're the literal and spiritual descendants of the first churchy Puritans. And then they're just kind of carrying that Massachusetts killjoy spirit across the Pacific to Hawaii with them.
They brought it to America, and then they insisted on creating new communities in different parts of the world, not just Hawaii.
No, not at all. American Indian communities, Turkey, I guess. They got the Armenians. An Armenian just told me. Places that really don't exist anymore, Palestine and Ceylon, they went to all over the place. They got around.
You must have relied on the writings of those missionaries for your source materials, but are there any documents from the Hawaiian people about what they thought was happening?
Yeah. The Bishop Museum has in it, its collection this letter. No, it's a report that one of the students at one of the mission schools wrote, and it's kind of I think it was written about 10 years after the missionaries arrived, and it's kind of looking back on what a Hawaiian student wrote it about what the Hawaiian people thought when these missionaries first showed up. And
the people thought,
these people are going to pray us to death. And, you know, they thought if they went into the church that that's where they were going to kill everyone. You know, so there was a little bit of trepidation.
But there. They pretty much all became Christianized, didn't they?
A lot of them, yeah.
In any of those journals, did anyone acknowledge the pretty beaches and the palm trees?
I think in maybe a letter or a diary of one of the missionary wives, when they were sailing, they landed at the Big Island and then they broke into two groups, and some of them stayed on the Big Island and others went on to Oahu. And one of the missionary wives who went to Oahu describes that moment of first seeing Oahu and seeing Diamond Head, and I think describes the beaches with the palm trees along the shore, but they were mostly, their writings were just them complaining about stuff. But they
complaining about what kind of, they were there
they
to
had
save
a lot
souls.
To complain about. Yeah, I mean
they weren't thinking of settling down.
Well, they were. Yeah, they thought they would never see their families again. You know, but I mean they had pretty hard lives, and I mean especially the missionary wives, because they had to do all the normal 19th century wife drudgery. You know, the laundry, the children, the cooking, and all that, and then they had to be teachers. They taught a lot of the Hawaiian students to read and write. And then they also, because it was a monarchy and an aristocracy, they had to be at the beck and call of the queens and the other aristocratic women and sew them dresses and, take care of their husbands and be the hostesses of the mission. And so they had a lot to do.
Aren't the Hawaiian Islands a relatively new geological formation?
They're still being formed every
day. The Big Island has.
Yeah, Kilauea.
So everything there, the flora and the fauna, is from somewhere else originally.
Yeah, including the Hawaiian people who are Polynesian voyagers who sailed from Tahiti and the Marquesas at least 1,000 years ago.
So they really couldn't say, well, we were here, this is our land, and you're invading.
Oh, yeah, they can say that. I mean, they had been there for, at least 900 years. And that's plenty of time to kind of settle in.
And when were they unified as some kind of an island nation entity?
That was in around 1810 or so. Kamehameha the Great, who was one of the, it had been a sort of, each island was its own chiefdom. And they were sort of interrelated but separate. And then Kamehameha, the Hawaiians say he united the islands, but really he conquered them. He was a pretty brutal conquering warrior, and he prosecuted these civil wars amongst all the islands and conquered them one by one, except for Kauai, who bent to his will eventually, and he established the Kingdom of Hawaii.
And then did it become relatively peaceful?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one reason he's so beloved. I mean, he's a very violent warrior king, you know, but then once he became king, the peace was pretty absolute.
And did his dynasty last until the queen finally was dumped from the throne?
Almost. I mean, no. His line died out. There was Kamehameha the second and third. They were his sons. I think the fourth was his grandson, and then the next guy was some sort of nephew. Only the last two monarchs were from a different dynasty.
To some degree, the royalty there is similar to what was happening in Egypt, wasn't it? Where there was a fair amount of incest. Why was that?
I guess that's true with Egypt, huh? Akhenaten. Let's see. Well, they believed, like a lot of, royalty worldwide, that to intermarry and breed with other people with less royal blood than themselves would weaken their bloodlines. The strength they believed in, it's called mana, like spiritual power.
So it was better to
like a brother
breed with your sibling.
Yeah, brother sister marriage was the highest form of spiritual power, and the children of those unions were especially sacred. And Kamehameha's wife was one such sacred person.
And they didn't have the problems that we often see with incest.
Yes, they
genetic
did.
Problems.
Yes, that's why. I mean, Kamehameha was the first and last Hawaiian monarch who gave birth to children who would live to adulthood to rule. So, yeah, it was, of course, that's the problem with, well, one of the problems with royalty.
One of the many problems with royalty.
Yeah.
Sarah Vowell's latest book is called Unfamiliar Fishes. It's published by Riverhead. And although this is about the New Englanders arriving on the islands, Europeans had come to Hawaii before them, hadn't they?
Well, sure. I mean, Captain Cook is the first recorded European, and he's the one who, quote unquote, discovered the islands.
And was killed.
By the Hawaiians, yes.
So did they fight off all Europeans who came their way?
No, that wasn't them fighting off the Europeans. That was this kind of scuffle in which, that was just sort of this lame moment of cultural misunderstanding where the Hawaiians had stolen one of the boats from Cook's ship, and because everything on that island belonged to that island's high chief, and so they took it, and then Captain Cook went to retrieve his boat because, hey, that's my private property. And in the scuffle, Cook was about, I think he was about to take the chief hostage until he got his boat back, and that's kind of a no-no. And so they sort of clobbered him, and it was just sort of a big, it's sort of the moment that makes you understand the importance of a translator, you know.
The state flag includes a Union Jack. So was Hawaii considered a British colony for a while, or British
the
possession?
The Hawaiians thought they were. Kamehameha he befriended George Vancouver, who was on Cook's expedition and then came back as the commander of his own Royal Navy expedition. And Kamehameha had given Vancouver to tell him that he would bow to the King of England and that the islands were a British protectorate. But the British, there's no record of the British ever acknowledging this.
I don't know how to interpret this, but a listener wrote in on our comment line, Estelle. She wonders, what got you interested in this topic?
It's pretty interesting, Estelle. Well, there are a lot of reasons. None of them sound
good. A number of people said, why Hawaii? What interested you in Hawaii? And there are cynics, of course, who suggest that this book was a good way to write off a trip to Hawaii.
Yeah. I'm not the kind of person that would go to Hawaii for fun, really, you know, I guess. But it was more my interest in that whole era of the 19th century, especially the time of annexation in 1898 and the Spanish-American War era and Hawaii's part in that.
Well, I wonder what this says about the listeners, Because if you'd written a book about California, for example, mm-hmm. which is one of the U.S.
Honestly,
states,
Leonard,
or
all
Alaska
of my...
or anywhere else, but Hawaii, for some reason, I guess because it's so far away, people question your motives.
People have this image of it as this paradise, right? But let me tell you, it's a real place with real problems, you know? I mean, for one thing, the whole time I was researching it, I mean, the state is still in horrible fiscal shape. And the whole time I was researching, they had these things called Furlough Fridays where the state did not have enough money to educate its school children. And so they could only go to school 4 days a week, you know? So on Fridays, I would be sitting in archives next to fellow researchers' children who are sitting there doing math, you know? So I think people think Hawaii and they just think of themselves sitting on a beach drinking an umbrella drink. But you can go there and have absolutely no fun at all, you know? Which is pretty much the writer, that's the writer's life.
Well, it must have been really tough for these missionaries to get there because this is before the Panama Canal opened.
Oh, yeah. It took about 6 months.
And why were they going there? Just simply to Christianize people, or did they save souls?
Isn't that enough? Isn't saving the souls of a people enough?
I guess the question there would be, why Hawaii? Why not a lot of other?
Well, one of the reasons that these New Englanders were so hell-bent on Hawaii was because of the first Hawaiian Christian, this youth named Henry Opukahaia, also known as Henry Obukia, who came to the mission school that they established in Connecticut for all four quote-unquote heathen youths from all of these boys from all over the world who ended up on New England ships in the China trade and ended up in New England, and also American Indian students. And this kid, Henry, it was his dream to go back and convert his people, and before he could do that, he died. And then the missionaries published this book about him called Memoirs of Henry Obukia that became their big PR tool in getting people interested in that mission and also getting donations to support it.
Did the American government have an interest in the islands at the beginning?
You just look at a map and you can see that those islands don't have a chance, you know, just they're just halfway between the U.S. and Asia. Pretty early on, it seemed like every time in the chronology when the Hawaiians are doing something they think will ensure their independence back in Washington, people are seeing it as strengthening the ties to those islands that will eventually lead to annexation. But,
because it was an ideal place for a naval base.
Yeah, and also for just, you know, commercial port as well.
But not everybody saw it in that way. Grover Cleveland, the president not long before annexation, mm-hmm. was against the idea, wasn't he?
Yeah, in fact, so those the missionary descendants overthrew the queen in order to hand the islands over to the U.S., and they had to wait 6 years because Grover Cleveland was president, and he sided with the queen, and he asked them to restore her to the throne, and they refused. So he called the annexation miserable business.
Well, the Hawaiians didn't want annexation.
No, they did not.
And the president of the United States didn't want it. Did something happen over those 6 years?
Yeah, a new president was elected. You know how that happens? The new guy comes in and
the policies change. Yeah, but he was assassinated, wasn't he?
Yeah, but not before he annexed Hawaii, you know. So he has there's a statue of McKinley there. There's a high school named after him.
And then Teddy Roosevelt became president.
Teddy Roosevelt
was assassinated. Was he really pro annexation?
He was gung-ho, yeah. Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, his best friend. There was a whole kind of cabal in the government, in the military, who wanted to acquire all these islands, including not just Hawaii, but Cuba and Puerto Rico and Guam, to use as military bases so as to beef up our navy to, you know, become an empire. And though there was a huge debate and not all Americans were in favor of this, they're the ones who got their way.
Who sponsored the missionaries? It must have been an expensive project.
It was. But one remedy for that is they paid these people practically nothing. It was this group based in Boston called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. And it was overseen by all the bigwigs of elite New England Protestantism at the time.
So they donated to the ABCFM?
Mm-hmm. They did. And then they, you know... they would get donations from churches at first all over New England, and then later on from all over the U.S.
And how many expeditions did they send?
In Hawaii, I think there were 12, I forget. 12 over about 40 years that mission lasted.
What was the religion before the Christians came?
It was the traditional Hawaiian religion. It was polytheistic, so there are various gods. You know, I guess the two main ones were the god of agriculture and peace and the god of war. And so for half the year, the god of agriculture and peace was in ascendance and the war god disappeared, and then vice versa.
We talked in to my
Which
previous...
is a good idea. It would be nice to, you know, have half a year where the war god goes on vacation, because we certainly don't have that.
Well, we're in March,
I would go for half an hour with that war, wouldn't you?
I was talking to my previous guest about forced assimilation.
Fun.
And to some degree, this is also part of your family history, isn't it?
Forced assimilation. Yeah, that's one way of putting it. I mean, some of my ancestors were on the Trail of Tears, so they were Cherokee, and they were kind of forced to move to Oklahoma, which, you know, that probably describes a lot of people who moved to Oklahoma. And then I have, you know, some Swedes and just normal European peasants.
I was thinking about the Cherokee and how that might have also affected your, you know, your interest in this.
Oklahoma, where I was born, was this sort of dumping ground for Indian tribes. And so, you know, most of the kids I went to school with, like, I'm also a Seminole too. It's just everyone there is kind of a mutt. So it does, I mean, there are very real connections between the Cherokee and the ABCFM. You know, they also are the same organization that Christianized the Cherokee, and they Christianized, in fact, the two of the leaders of the treasonous group of Cherokee who signed the bogus treaty with the government, making the Trail of Tears seem sort of legal against the wishes of the rest of the tribe. They went to that same school in Connecticut that Henry Obukia went to. So, I mean, when I was researching this and reading all the old mission reports, I could go back and forth between the, you know, what they were doing with the Cherokee and with the Hawaiians. And the same, you know, their goal with the Cherokee, as stated, was to make them English in their manners and dress and English in their thought. So it was about, you know, Christianity has this kind of inherent goal of making everyone believe the same thing. But I think one of the side effects of that is, you know, sometimes Christians maybe want everyone to be exactly all alike in every aspect of their lives.
Although not just on a religious level. The missionaries said they wanted to help the Hawaiians with farming and with trade, although the locals were already doing quite well on their own, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the agriculture was pretty sophisticated there. They had all these fish ponds, and, you know, their main crop is taro, which is a wetland crop, and they had figured out how to grow that in the dry plains. So the goal of the missionaries, as stated, was to cover the islands with fruitful fields, but they were already pretty fruitful when the missionaries showed up.
There's a word that comes up many times as you write about the missionaries. The word is palapala. What's that?
Oh, that's like a lot of the wonderful thing about Hawaiian nouns is they can mean so many different things. It means learning, language, books. It's also the word the Hawaiians gave for the Bible. It can be deeds, laws.
But all new to the islands because there was no written language before 1819?
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of the missionaries. They did create and invent the written Hawaiian language. They taught basically the entire population to read within a generation. They published millions of pages in Hawaiian. But they also, you know, introduced the concepts of private property and, you know, other non-literary kind of palapala, like.
Although there are still some things that haven't been resolved. For example, writing out the word Hawaii, which some do with an apostrophe, others like you leave out the apostrophe.
Yeah. Well, that's because I wrote my book in English. In the Hawaiian language, There is, I forget what that's called, the little apostrophe between I and I. But when I was researching this, sometimes it was hard until I learned a lot of Hawaiian words, because some of the more academic books, they quote so many Hawaiian words all the time. It was sort of hard to make out. And I my book is for the English reader. And
are there still a lot of people speaking Hawaiian, or at least using Hawaiian words in Hawaii?
Yeah. Starting in the 60s and 70s, there was this renaissance in which the Hawaiian people started revisiting their language and culture in droves. And, you know, there's a very healthy movement of immersion schools for children. And, you know, it's on the uptick.
Midway through the book, you write, "My research into Hawaiian culture had made me more aware of my own biases and prejudices than any project I'd worked on."
Mm-hmm.
In what way?
Well, for one thing, I mean, I guess I would have known that I'm not so keen on monarchy. But the curious thing about this story is, you know, the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarch is, it is, as Cleveland said, miserable business. But there's a part of me that understood why those, you know, New England descendants, part of it was they just had complete and total disdain for that form of government. And to the Hawaiians, it just meant they had disdain for, you know, this constitutional form of government that they had themselves chosen and lived with for, you know, generations. And sometimes I found myself kind of understanding the icky overthrowers, just because I, you know, I have no real warmth for monarchy. And so I was constantly going back and forth between my real and true admiration for the queen as a person, as a writer, as a Hawaiian, versus, you know, just going back to some of that old 1776 ire that we're all born with over here.
On the other hand, I suspect you're no admirer of imperialism. And this is an annexation in 1898 was just part of a whole orgy of American imperialism.
That's right. I mean, it was a choice that we made, that this country made. We turned this corner, and a lot of it is owed to this one book by a lecturer at the Naval War College named Alfred Mann about the influence of sea power upon history. And he argued that the great empires, Britain, Rome, etc., that their power was based on sea power, and it required a substantial navy that was supported by island bases off the coast of the home nation. And this book was beloved by Theodore Roosevelt, by Lodge, people in the administration and the military, and it had a lot of influence on the most influential people in the government.
The book, I never asked you what unfamiliar fishes means, but we've run out of time.
I guess they'll have to read the book.
Sarah Vowell's Unfamiliar Fishes is published by Riverhead Books, and Sarah, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Back at you, Leonard.